This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT. I'm Jennifer Staten. Have you ever heard summer called trauma season? You probably haven't unless you work in an emergency room. Workers there know the time roughly between Memorial Day and Labor Day can be very busy. Kids are done with school, more people are outside for swimming, boating, barbecues, and stuff like that. And all of that means more ER visits for matters trivial to traumatic. Dr. Pat Crocker saw his share of all of the above during his career as the director of the emergency department at Breckenridge Hospital, at Children's Hospital of Austin, and then Dell Children's Medical Center. He's gathered some of those stories into his book, Letters from the Pit, Stories of a Physician's Odyssey in Emergency Medicine. I talked with Crocker about the changes in emergency medicine he's seen during his 37-year career and what was hardest for him to master in the ER.
Well, very early on, according to my mother, I told her I wanted to be a physician. Somewhere along the line, I became very interested in emergency medicine because it offered some excitement and a wide variety of patients. I mean, we treat everything. Newborns, children, adults, fractures, trauma, heart attacks, strokes. And that seemed really appealing to me. And so that's how I got hooked on emergency medicine.
Did you see emergency room medicine and patients? Did you see that landscape change during your career? You know, I think we think of emergency rooms as, you know, emergencies are rushing in, terrible cases all the time. But I also know that because of the way our healthcare landscape has evolved, it's also where people go who often don't have access to other providers. And that's sort of their healthcare of last resort, if you will. What did you see over the years in that regard?
Honestly, I don't think it's changed a whole lot yet. If anything, there are probably a few less patients with acute minor problems that come to the ER. But you're absolutely right. There are still lots of them there. And it's the least cost-effective way to care for that group of population who has no other access to health care. One of the ways we try to deal with that is establish a second track through the emergency department where people with very minor acute problems, colds, sprains, minor lacerations, can be treated by a nurse practitioner even though they came to the emergency department. And that's helped quite a bit.
So I want to read just a brief portion from the book and get your response. And it's about that idea of relationship with a patient. And you wrote, "I come to my first realization that a career in the ER is not survivable without distancing yourself from your patients. If you feel too much empathy, you also will become a casualty. I don't know how I feel about setting myself apart from my patients. I want to care for people. That's why I chose medicine. Now I've learned that I can't care about them too much. It's such a painful incongruity. How do you care for those you can't truly care about? Will I be able to walk this tightrope without faltering? I honestly don't know." I'd love to hear you describe how you walked that tightrope and how you kind of navigated that tension.
It is a very difficult problem in emergency medicine, and probably for every physician. You need to feel some empathy for the patient, or you lose the humanity of medicine. And I think it's really the human connection of medicine that makes it a happy and sustaining career. So you can't lose that. At the same time, you can't get too locked into your patient's tragedy, whatever it is. Otherwise, you too become a casualty because you identify with them and, you know, you feel their pain. And trying to walk that line sort of between empathy and self-harm was something that I had to struggle with at times.
How did you figure out how to walk that line, or how did you yourself manage that?
I'm not sure I have a great answer for that. One of the things that I think helps is shaking the patient's hand, sitting down next to him, and actually communicating face to face. And that allows you to establish some of that human link that makes you feel better about caring for some medical disaster or even a minor problem. Because if you can't find satisfaction from that and depend, like many emergency physicians, on the adrenaline rush of the high-intensity trauma case or major emergency, on most days, you're going to be disappointed with your practice. So that's how I kept that. And I tried to connect with the patient at that level, but somehow you have to create an internal wall. I mean, there's a story in the book about a young man who came in with a swollen arm, seemingly a minor problem. He was actually in minor care. And what I learned during the course of working him up and examining him and testing was that he had a very severe advanced cancer at a very young age. So you're struggling with this connection you've established with the patient and the fact that you have to walk back into the room in a little while and tell him he may be dying. At the least, he's facing a major course of chemotherapy and a whole lot of care. And it's trying.
Well, and these are also patients, because it's an emergency room setting, you may never see them again. They're there for an acute episode or something specific, but it isn't by design an ongoing relationship. You have to sort of create, build, and sustain that relationship all in one visit.
Yes. And that's one of the things that I've felt has been a failing for the emergency medicine physician, and that is the lack of sort of knowing what happens ultimately. We have our little piece of the chain of treatment or chain of survival, so to speak, and once our piece has gone through the machine, they're gone. So one thing I did was, with cases I thought were really interesting or patients that I had felt a little bit more of a special connection with, is I would give them my email and say, you know, hey, in a month, if you think about it, why don't you drop me a line and tell me what happened? So that helped some with that. But you're absolutely right. It's a career that's experienced in vignettes. And that's why I wrote the book as a series of vignettes, because it exactly mirrors the experience of the emergency medicine physician.
Those patients that you invited to email you after you all saw each other, would they do that?
About three quarters of them did drop me a line later and let me know what happened, and I appreciated that, but not everyone.
Can you describe for us a little bit about what life was like as an emergency room doctor? I'm imagining lots of long hours, and as you describe in the book, you know, some extremely difficult, traumatic cases. How did that impact you?
Well, you're right. It was a very busy career, for sure. And besides being director of the two emergency departments for a long time, I did a lot of other activities, volunteer outside of the ER. And at the time, I didn't really realize what the cost of that was. I knew I was missing some things, but I was living my dream. I mean, that was my dream, to be director of an emergency department at a big trauma center. It wasn't until after I retired that I fully understood some of the costs of that. You know, a friend of mine has reminded me from time to time that behind every good man, there's an even better woman. And you can change the pronouns around however they're needed to be, but it's a career that is really the product of two people. And without the support at home, I could have never done all the things that I did.
You said you didn't realize some of the costs until after you were finished and you were in retirement. What were some of those costs?
Oh, and it's the same with, I think, all busy physicians. And that's, you're going to miss some things that happen at home that you would like to not have missed. The career of an emergency physician is nothing like the television personification. I mean, you work nights a third of the time. You work late evening to the middle of the night a third of the time, and you only work days a third of the time. So for two-thirds of your working life, you're away from home. And then after working those late shifts, you've got to sleep the next day. So there are going to be things you miss. Things as your child grows up, soccer games, piano recitals, all those things. Also, we work every weekend, every holiday, and you have to pull your share of those. So you're gone a lot more than you would have thought as a medical student.
So you described doing these jobs, being an emergency room physician, that you were living your dream. Then you also just described the difficult schedule and the costs for that. How did you know that it was time to stop?
That's a really interesting question. And once one of my older friends retired, a very busy trauma surgeon who practiced, I admired, had retired, I called him and said, you know, hey, how did you know it was time? And he said, essentially, don't worry, you'll just know. And, you know, one day I got up and it wasn't quite as much fun as it used to be. And there's a growing burden of computer work, paperwork generation, all sorts of things that have been thrust onto the physician now. And that's very different from when I started. And those things are really not very satisfying to do. And I think it leads to more dissatisfaction. And finally, I decided, you know, I've been the guy in the ER waiting for the disaster for 37 years now, and that was enough.
So you've pointed to things that are inherently difficult about the job and things that have changed, such as the amount of paperwork. What would you say to young people or med students who might want to do what you have done and be an emergency room physician?
I think the possibility of having an incredible career doing what I think was the most fascinating job I could do is still possible. But I think they need to be aware that right now, the 2019 Medscape survey of physicians showed that 48% of emergency physicians feel burned out, and only 4% were actually happy at work. And to me, that's tragic. I think for me, what kept me satisfied and gratified was that human connection. I hear patients all the time say they've gone to the emergency room with some injury and the doctor never even introduced himself and was curt and didn't want to listen, and that was that. If those are the kind of encounters you're going to live through on a day-to-day basis, you are never going to be happy doing emergency medicine. I think you really have to work to understand that what you're doing is helping another human. And whether it is a mild, minimal health issue or a major emergency, I think the touch, shaking hands or a pat on the side of the shoulder when you introduce yourself, sitting down next to the patient and looking at them eye to eye, if you can't find some gratification from that, emergency medicine is not for you. Because let's face it, the rush of adrenaline is brief. Adrenaline has a 2.5 minute half-life. But the satisfaction from helping people is where the long-term gratification comes from.
So you described some things that emergency room physicians or aspiring emergency room physicians can do to make that practice and situation better, things they can do on their side of the equation. Are there systemic changes that you think hospitals or healthcare organizations could do to make things better from that side of the equation?
Yes, I do think so. The electronic medical record has been a terrific advance, but it's still sort of an undelivered promise. And administrators, I don't think, really understand that we went from 5 or 10 years ago to maybe 10% of the day in front of the computer generating charts, et cetera, to well over half our day. In fact, maybe 60%+ of the day is spent in front of the computer generating paperwork. Some recognition around that would help. then there are other systemic problems, I think, and some stories in the book that bring those out that are particularly unsatisfying. And one is what I would call when less care is better care. You know, focusing on that futile end-of-life care that's so hard because most patients and families and doctors have not really sat down and talked to each other about what they really wanted. And I understand we're talking about a family's loved ones, but at some point, there's nothing else we can do. The cycle of life has come around, and interfering with more medications and hospitalizations and treatment, or even institutionalizing a patient, really just prolongs suffering and makes no sense. So when you're the doctor that has to go in and sit down with the family and say, you know, grandpa's dying, and they say, well, we need everything done. We're not in a position to say, nope, I'm not going to give them antibiotics. We're going to let the pneumonia take them because it's the most humane course. And so you get stuck into situations like that that, for me, don't make sense and are uncomfortable. Another situation that we see, and it's a system failure, and there's a story in the book about this, as well. I had an HIV patient who could no longer afford his medications after loss of a job, but he still couldn't qualify for Medicaid until he was absolutely destitute. So he presented with a severe exacerbation of a lung infection because he hadn't been taking his medicines. And you have similar discussions with patients because some of the pharmacy costs are totally ridiculous and make the drugs unobtainable for many, even blood pressure medications that were $5 for a month at Walmart 5-10 years ago are now over $100. And it's the same old generic medicine. So those sorts of situations just add to the long-term wear and tear on the physician dealing with that sort of thing. Another one is, you know, the over-medication of America. There's an encounter where I had an elderly patient come in with the family convinced she was having a stroke, and for all the world, it looked like she'd had a severe stroke. I found out she was on 15 medications. And so we went through the list and threw some out and observed her for the course of the day, and 2 weeks later, she was able to resume her old life, awake and alert, and was really being poisoned by all the medications. So it's those sorts of things that I think point to a real system failure that not only contributes to the perception of poor care and difficult outcomes for patients, but also for their physicians, because we're right in the middle of it with them. And I have to believe that it's time to really start serious conversations about some sort of basic Medicare-type coverage for everybody. I'm not a fan of socialized medicine at all, but something in between where the patient still has a stake in the game, like Medicare. They are responsible for 20% of the bill, but they can get better pharmacy costs that make their medications affordable. It makes far more sense to spend $10 a month to take care of somebody's blood pressure than to ignore it and 30 years later spend $1 million treating them for their severe stroke. So I think it's time to think about that problem. And I would say right now, neither the far right nor the far left are really telling the whole story.
Can you tell us what for you was perhaps the toughest or the most challenging case that you ever encountered in an emergency room?
Sure. One that stood out tremendously was a young man who was brought to the emergency department after a motor vehicle accident and en route developed cardiac arrest. And we all thought, all right, you know, we're not going to get anywhere with this. But we still gave it our best shot and we resuscitated him. And we still thought, oh, geez, 12 minutes of CPR and blunt abdominal and head trauma. His future is probably bleak. But he went off to the OR and got his operation. And I followed him along And after about 5 days, I learned he was moved up to the floor, which meant he was off all life support, etc. And I talked to the doctor, and he said, he's actually doing quite well. And I still remember going up to his room and peeking in the door, and here was this kid who had presented dead, and he's watching TV and eating his breakfast. And getting to be part of that sort of miracle is something that sticks with you.
A lot of the stories that you've been telling about specific cases in the emergency room are surprising, or they contain a phrase, you know, we all thought something was going to happen, and then something else radically different happened. What kind of thinking or mindset do emergency room doctors have in a fast-moving situation like that? It sounds like that often there are surprises.
There often are surprises. And this is also a major hurdle for physicians. We all tend to fall into some of the cognitive errors of medicine. And these are errors, and the one in particular is called premature diagnostic closure. It's when we see you, hear your complaints, examine you, and decide, yep, you probably have X. If we can't change our mind, and as data accumulates, lab tests or x-rays or your condition changes, to realize, uh-oh, they actually have Y. That's the error of premature diagnostic closure. And the patients suffer, and you will suffer, and you have to be able to continually be open to all the new information that's coming your way. And that's actually a big hurdle. It's hard to overcome your own thinking once you've thought what may be the wrong thing. The other thing that was a very difficult path is that of, and it's one of the themes of the book, primum non nocere, or first do no harm. It's a phrase we all learned early in medical school, and it sounds so simple and straightforward. Most of us never gave it another thought. But as the years of practice went on, I started to really understand doing no harm is not that easy. Every medication has many side effects that can affect a patient, and trying to balance, are the potential side effects worth the treatment, and who do I put at risk of those, and who should I not? The same thing with therapies. You know, every medical therapy can have complications. And trying to balance all that out and still care for the patient can be a challenge. And the way I usually handled it was to talk to the patient and tell them the pros and cons and say, you know what, I would do this if you were my family member. This is what I would recommend. And that explanation usually helped them make their decision. You know, is it worth the risk of the treatment and complications or not?
Dr. Pat Crocker is author of Letters from the Pit, Stories of a Physician's Odyssey in Emergency Medicine.